This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, open year-round. Learn more at bbg.org. This week on Meat and Three, it's our season four finale, and we're sharing some of our greatest kitchen joys.
Maybe most people consider making it too much work or too messy, but this is the food that's worth the work and worth the wait.
You always know where the thing is because you put it away the right way the first time.
You just sort of stand there and, you know, with your hand on your hip and one leg outstretched, glass of wine in your hand, staring into the refrigerator going, okay, speak to me.
Oh yeah, what are you doing with the celery tonight?
I am making a simple syrup for a gin cocktail with the celery. And I also found a recipe for a celery soup that's going to use up the celery and the potatoes and some of that dill that we still have hanging out in there.
Tune in and be inspired to find the joy in your kitchen. And don't forget to subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's going to save your soul. The devil wants his groove in them rhythm and blues that Sam is going to get you some.
Welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm Souther Teague, and I'm here at Tales of the Cocktail 2019, hanging out at the Diageo Jazz Feast with barman proprietor Sean Kenyon of Denver, Colorado. Sean, welcome. Welcome great. To my makeshift mobile studio.
Yeah, great to be here hanging out with you, brother.
Super comfortable hanging out in the hallway. Dude, you are, I mean, you kind of go without need of introduction. People know who you are because of your reputation. You've been in this game literally all your life. Talk to me about a little bit. I don't need your whole CV, but like, talk to me a little bit about like what got you kind of going, and then we'll talk about what we're doing now.
Well, I can easily say that I'm the only person that I know that is doing at age 50 what I wanted to do when I was five. I wanted to be a bartender. You know, I saw what my father did, what my mother did later. What my grandfather did, and I saw, you know, that people love them. They were magnetic. They were the life of the party, you know, and people really enjoyed being around them. Not just them, the people that worked for them as well. You know, I grew up as an overweight kid, didn't have a lot of friends, got made fun of a lot, even in my younger years, bullied a little bit before I grew up. And the bar was home for me as much as being at my house was. You know, when I would go to school and people were cruel to me, I would go to the bar and everybody loved me. You know, I was my father's son. They were, you know, my mother always referred to them as my drunken uncles. But, you know, the bar regulars became my family and became a safer place for me than outside of school. So I can't remember a time where I didn't want to be part of this when I was older and didn't want to be the person who was standing behind the bar and making everybody happy. And even though I went to school, you know, I went to college because my dad didn't want me to be a bartender, I still, you know, I bartended all the way through and still pushed through and you know, made a career out of it. I mean, it wasn't until just a few years ago where people stopped asking me when I was going to get a real job.
Yeah, I still face that as well. And I think it's just, you know, let's compare financials. That's usually what I say.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's compare financials.
Yeah.
Open your books. I'll open mine. So you got your start in your own family's bar, right?
Yeah.
You were relating a story to me offline about your first sort of getting pitched behind the bar and that sort of.
You got
your dad's hackles up a little bit.
Yeah, you know, the bartending started as a fluke. You know, a guy went out on July 4th and got wasted and didn't show up to work on July 5th. And I was bar backing. And, you know, it was, you know, everybody looking at each other, you know, like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? You know, and there I am, you know, a 16-year-old. And they're like, well, Sean knows what he's doing. You think he can do it? And I was like, yeah, of course I can.
Yeah. Young man bravado. Yeah. I can do everything.
Of course. I can do this. No problem. And you know, it started that way, and it ran for a week or so till my dad got back into town, and you know, he yelled at everybody, and you know, called him in for a meeting, screamed at him for an hour, and then on my way out, they, you know, on their way out, you know, he looked at him and he was like, well, how do you do? And you know, after all the yelling, and you know, I think there was probably a proud moment there, and they let me continue to do so.
Yeah, I heard you had to have a fake ID.
Yeah, fake
that
ID.
That you weren't allowed to leave with.
Yeah, a fake ID posted behind the bar that I wasn't allowed to take. I mean, not that being 18 would have gotten me, you know, done me any good, because it had just turned back to 21
right.
in New Jersey, I think in like 1980 something, like early 1980s. So mm-hmm. 18 could have bought me cigarettes, but I wasn't a smoker, so it really didn't matter that much. Yeah.
That's great. And, you know, I think a lot of bartenders like us have origin stories that are maybe not as unique as that one. But I feel like origin stories for bartenders are kind of like, well, I just lucked into it. I stumbled behind the bar, all this crap. But you have this sense of home when you think about a bar that I think is pretty unique. And then even your first shift sounds very unique. And like, expound on that a little bit if you can.
You know, it's always felt like home to me. And I grew up watching not only my father taking care of his guests like they were at home, you know, they were in his home, but you know, his bartenders doing the same. And then he took care of his family, his staff, you know, I mean, he still called them staff or bartenders, you know. And I brought that into my own bars. Like I always wanted to create a home-like environment, you know, for everybody. Like, you know, I think I've said it before, is, you know, build a family, don't hire a staff. So we treat everybody, because when I grew up, the bartenders and servers and dishwashers and kitchen people, those people came to our house, you know, they came over to my family's house for Thanksgiving and Christmas and the like. And it was, you know, I saw that he treated everybody, no matter what position they were in the building, as equals, you know. And I learned, he never sat me down and told me that, but he did. You know, I did learn by osmosis, and you know, he seems to be, my father's one of those people who's like super wise without knowing that he is.
Right. Well, I think that's true of a lot of career bartenders. You know, yeah. You log enough years literally communicating with human beings, you pick up wisdom.
Yeah.
I mean, whether you are aware, I think sometimes a lack of self-awareness of how wise you've become.
Yeah. And it's crazy. It's crazy because I you know, I quote my father all the time, and he always, you know, he'll even say stuff like, I never knew I was that quotable, you know, or I don't remember ever saying that. I never said that. I was like, yeah, right. You did.
I learned it from you, Dad.
Yeah, I learned it exactly from you. But yeah, the home part, I think about, you know, because when we build our staff, we look at family chemistry, right? I mean, everybody's, there's going to be your parents, there's going to be your older children, your middle children, your younger children, you know, the cousins, the kind of outliers, but you're building a chemical unit, right? You want it to mesh well. If you hire all type A personalities, you know, that are just driven and pushing towards the top, then in the end, it's going to end in disaster in my mind. I mean, you have to have leaders, followers, and people that can adjust to both to make it work. I mean, we're at a point where we could have hired whoever we wanted in town at one point.
Sure, Sean Kenyon's opening up a place. People are lining up to get there, right?
But yeah, I mean, and that's different now. Like, there's so many bars in Denver. When we were opening, we were one of only two existing new cocktail bars in town. I mean, there's been a couple that were around for years, but at that time we could have had our pick. And it's, you know, you don't just pick all the number ones. You know, it's not, if you're trying to build a team that lasts, you know, you don't pick all the number ones. You don't want a marquee, you know, of headliners and support it, you know, like all that up front and put people's names up and stuff like that. I think because you want them to think like a family, you know, and they act like a family, but we never consciously told them that's what we were doing. You know, everybody was hired because that was, you know, they were the right position in the right time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think I'm terrible at sports, but you made a sports analogy about this. You said, you know, that's why the All-Stars only play once a year, right? Because they wouldn't last as a team all year long.
All-Star teams play once a year, and that's the only way they could really exist. I mean, it's, if you put all number ones on, there was a bar in Denver years ago that did do exactly that. They hired all these people who ran programs from around town, and they were, you know, they were like, they kept, in the media, they kept pushing, like, look at all these rock stars we hired, look at all these rock stars, and referring to them as rock stars. And in my mind, I was just thinking, like, that might, you know, that can't last. I mean, it can be great for a while, and you know, you can get some talent and some creativity out of it. But you know, when it gets into the normal grind of, you know, of running your bar every night and taking care of guests every night, egos are going to clash at that point. You know, I mean, I think the whole thing lasted for them about 2 weeks before the first person quit, and then it was like
dominoes.
Yeah. Everybody just quit until nobody was left.
I get that. You know, I think my teams are super small, like four of us.
Yeah.
So I can get away kind of with hiring all stars because we work alone. Each of us works a shift by ourselves. Yeah. But when I hired for my newest bar, which is much bigger, yeah, I had to be like, okay, well, I need a pitcher, I need a catcher, I need a guy who can hit. Like, I can't just hire all pitchers, or we got a baseball team.
Yeah, you can't have all home run hitters,
right?
You know,
we're going nowhere.
High strikeout rate. You know, I mean,
right.
It's you need people to set the table too. You know, if you want to go deep into sports analogies there, you know. But I think, you know, when you think of that as a chemical unit and whatever works for you, you know, I mean, because it was amazing. I took Leo DeGroff came with me. Or came with us on one of our staff trips, which we do every year. And, you know, he remarked to me afterwards, he's like, your staff is so close. It's amazing. Like, there was no cliques. You know, like, we have 18 people, and it's not like people separating off into cliques. Everybody was just together.
Yeah.
And when everybody went out together, and nobody was stepping away from the group. They wanted everybody to experience everything, you know, as a unit, which is great. Because you can do that on your work time, but when you get in your off time, that's when you see how people really feel about you, right? Or how they feel about each other, because they can tend to separate and move around. But on their off time, on their relaxing time, they still chose to be together, you know, rather than trying to, you know, on their free time, because there was free time built into the whole thing every day, you know, they still stay together, which is great.
Yeah, that's a pretty powerful visual statement. I mean, what do you think it is that you're doing other than, you know, trying to pick out a team that has a full roster in this continued, metaphor? What is it you think that you're doing that's cultivating that sort of kinship among your team?
I think it's tough. It really is. I think they have to see that I care, that I care about them as individuals before I care about the money and the ring and the shift. You know, I care about them. I want to know who they are. My interviews are very, my interviewing style is very, it's not very standard. You know, I mean, it's not cookie cutter. I'm not going to ask people, like, if you're a tree, what kind of tree would you be kind of thing. You know, I don't really ask interview questions. It's not I don't care. I can find out about your work history. I can find out, you know, from your bosses how you handled situations. I want to know about you. Right. I want to know who you are. I want to know that you have a desire to that you have a natural desire to take care of people. I take people out to a coffee shop to start, you know, like, and I let them order their own coffee, and I'd see if they I'm watching them the entire time, but I'm not obvious about it. I'm not staring them down. But, you know, I want to see if they treat the person behind the counter like a human being and not like a vending machine. You know, I want them to say hello. Like, I do that. I walk into a convenience store, I say hello to everybody. It's never just a quick one-on-one transaction, but I want them to say hello. I want them to, you know, maybe ask them how they're doing or whatever, just but want to interact with the human behind there. That's a step. It's not going to make or break depending on our conversation.
Sure.
But, you know, second step is my second interview is usually at a bar somewhere. You know, not trying to get anybody drunk, you know, just to have a drink and also see how they interact with people. But, you know, once they get into a comfortable environment, like a bar that we're hanging out in, you know, whether they drink or not drink, and it's not a test. If they don't want to drink, that's fine. But I like to see what they look, where they are when it's more relaxed, you know, and I have a drink, you know, and they're welcome to, but some people do. Some people think it's a trick, you know, but for us, I think checking in with them individually regularly. I send texts to my staff all the time just to see how they're doing, you know, or I'll see that they got a great review, you know, whether it be on Yelp or Google or whatever it is.
Oh, Sean.
Yeah.
Don't be started by Yelp.
You know, yeah. Oh, don't, I'm not, you know, I don't put any stock in it. Nobody gets yelled at for one-star reviews or any of that stuff.
I'm notorious and been on record many times as saying I have never and I will never read Yelp. I sleep better than you, guaranteed.
Good for you, yeah.
I can't even.
That's awesome. I get the alerts and I look at them every once in a while. I don't keep an eye on our rating, but either way, I check in with them a lot. And I think I don't think there's a single person that works for us that doesn't know that I care about them as individuals. But it also, you know, that makes it hurt that much more when they leave. You know, we've not had many over the years. Our turnover rate with bartenders is extremely low. You know. I mean, we might lose one every couple of years, you know?
That's incredible.
And you know, we just had one just took a national brand ambassador job, Valerie Alvarado. She's amazing. And, you know, I knew she was looking for the next thing, and I actually helped and recommended her for the job. And, you know, but still, when you get I took the offer.
Yeah.
Text or, you know, the conversations, it's difficult. It feels like your heart's getting ripped out a little bit. It's like a member of your family leaving, or, you know, being a parent and your kid goes off to college for the first time or they're gone, right? You know, and
it's bittersweet. And, you want to see them go on, but you also like, fuck, yeah, man.
And I mean, you know,
hang out with me some more.
I wish we could have kept her for good, you know, but people move on, and now she'll be sitting on the other side of the bar spending brand money and, you know, hanging out. She'll still be around, and that's exciting for us. But I think it's caring and actually caring about people and having conversations and eye contact and remembering, you know, remembering what's going on with them and being sensitive to things. It's much different than when I started in this business. I mean, I was pretty much one of my first manager, McKay, was a hard ass. I didn't care what your problems were, as long as you were good behind the bar. You know, it took a long time to mature into where I feel now. And sometimes I think it's almost to the detriment of the business side, because I don't talk about how much they rang or what their numbers were last night. All those things happen because we set the table. You know, it's a build it and they will come philosophy, right? We set the table, people are happy, they're gonna radiate that out to the guests about how happy they are in their own workplace. That positivity kind of reigns, and the money comes later. Like it's there. We have an assistant general manager and, you know, accountants that do that stuff, and I honestly don't think about the money in any way. And I know that sounds altruistic and like bullshit.
I disagree. I'm kind of the same way.
Yeah.
I know if everything's in place and working correctly,
yeah,
then that's just part of the equation.
Yeah.
It'll just be there at the end.
It's
at the end, there it is. Boom. And it's there every day.
It's to me that, you know, there are people, there are accounts. I'm a creative. I'm terrible at organizing things inside, you know, within spreadsheets and all those kind of things at work, at the bar. I mean, when I'm doing them for events, I got that stuff down.
Right.
But, you know, there, my priorities are that everybody's happy, you know, and that we've set the table for the people to come in and us to take care of them.
Well, I love that when you say, well, I can see it in your eyes, when you say, yeah, I'm there when I want everyone to be happy, you're saying my staff,
yeah,
you're saying the guest, you're, yeah, saying the guy who brings the citrus, you're saying the guy who drops off the booze.
Yeah.
You want everyone to be happy.
Right.
I can really see it and hear it in your voice when you say it.
It's funny. You see these bar managers that like whip on their distributor reps and, you know, they beat them down and they treat it like it's a challenge, like it's a me versus them thing. If you bring them in and you know, they become your friends and you treat them like one of your own, then they naturally want to take care of you however they can. If you're beating them down all the time, they're going to fuck you wherever they can.
Yep.
You know, no matter how powerful you believe you are in your own market. If you treat people poorly on the distributor side, then they're not going to help you out where they can, whether there's allocated items or whether there's price breaks you can get. They're not going to call you for a price break if you're an asshole. They're
call you to let you know that you could save money. You right. either find it or you don't find it.
But I've sat at bars, at other people's bars, because my ears are always open. I can't, you know, we can't turn off our eyes and ears when we go to places, right? And listen to bar managers just destroy their salespeople and you know, I mean, just not treat them, you know, not treat them very well. So it's everybody, yes. It's not just the people that are working under the roof. It's the people that we do work with that we want to treat well.
Yeah. Sean, that sounds like a great point to pause. Just got to pause for a commercial break here from our sponsors here at Heritage Radio Network. You're listening to The Speakeasy. My guest today, Sean Kenyon from Denver. Stay tuned.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden. A stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn featuring spectacular plant displays year-round. Mark your calendars for Saturday, September 28th, when the Chili Pepper Festival returns to Brooklyn Botanic Garden. At this all-day celebration of all things hot and spicy, indulge in sizzling bites from 40 food artisans. Enjoy spicy food demonstrations, foodie-friendly tours and talks, activities for kids, and live performances by musicians and artists around the garden. Stay through the evening for a special concert that brings New Orleans to Brooklyn. Festival goers can jam out to the legendary New Orleans musicians John Papa Gross, Walter Wolfman Washington, and New Orleans Queen of Soul, Irma Thomas. Joining the fun will be Big Chief Monk Boudreau, bringing the traditions of the Mardi Gras Indians to the heart of Brooklyn. Learn more about Brooklyn Botanic Garden at bbg.org.
Do you love this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. We have over 35,000 shows in our online library. My name is Jennifer Leuzzi, and I'm the host of Tech Bites, where we talk to innovators and influencers in the food tech space. You can find Tech Bites wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org. Thanks for listening.
And welcome back to the Speakeasy. I'm here at Tales of the Cocktail 2019, hanging out with Sean motherfucking Kenyon. That was your moniker for a while.
Yeah, I mean, with the middle name is Michael Francis.
I never knew that part.
Yeah.
It all comes together.
Yeah, it's that's also Dave Wondrich's fault. It was like whenever I walked in a room, that's how he would refer to me, and other people picked up on it.
Yeah,
and that's where we are.
I'm going to apologize just one more time for the background noise, but we're in a working site right here, so noise is going to happen. So just turn your radio up. Sean, you've got three now places in Denver, Colorado. Your first baby was Williams Graham. God damn it, fix me.
Williams and Graham.
Williams and Graham. Then you opened Occidental and most recently American Bonded. Talk about that lineup. What makes them special, and how you deal with them?
So they're all three bars are very different. I took a long time to open my first bar. I turned down 18 business plans altogether. You know, I still have a lot of them sitting around, but it just, until something was right, I didn't want to do it. And I was super comfortable working for other people, you know, I mean, getting all the benefit, but none of the headache, you know, and I, you know,
by headache, you mean responsibility. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. I mean, it was fun being a bartender with no responsibility outside of what's going on inside your doors. Owning a bar changes that, you know, you're responsible for the people, you know, you say one wrong thing on the social media and your bar gets, people stop coming to your bar. You've just affected 40 people's jobs. Right.
Right. So can we actually take a detour and talk about social media for a second?
Yeah,
you're like a loud voice.
Yeah. You know,
I mean, I follow you on all of it. And when I see you say something, I'm typically like nod my head in either agreement or disagreement. But then I look and see like 400 comments in the last hour.
Yeah.
Like people listen to you. You are engaging.
Yeah. So you have to be very careful. Right. And I think, you know, people, I got this reputation for a number of years about ranting about things and, you know, people would send me texts like, we're looking forward to your next rant. It's like it's not a plan. Like it's not, right. I see things and I know I have a platform. I have, you know, I have 5,000 followers on Instagram and Facebook and all that. It's not even not a lot compared to some of my friends.
It's just that they're engaged with you though. They respond.
Yeah.
You know? That's more powerful than 20,000 that don't respond.
It's an engaged group and it's people that care about what we care about as an industry, you know, and I've really worked on making sure that my messages contain positivity, even though it might be something about what's wrong with our industry. You know, this is where we can be, you know, is what I want to present. I'm lucky because I get a lot of people that can't respond for brand reasons or whatever that send me direct texts or direct messages about, you know, like, I really love that. My brand can't, you know, because of my brand, I can't comment on it. But, you know, I've seen a lot in this industry. I've done a lot in this industry. I'm lucky to be involved in it, and I'm constantly, you know, I want to be able to share and I want to be able to listen too. You know, the hard thing about social media and where everybody puts us is that it's really hard to listen while you're screaming all the time.
Yeah.
You know, so you have to if you're going to throw something out there, you have to stop and listen to the responses to it. You know, you can't just post and then not look at any of your comments or anything, because if you want to engage, you know, and something you've said may have hurt a sector of people or may have hurt, you know, a person or a group or a brand, you know, then you want to know that. You have to listen and you have to be, you can't just go rant without any kind of reprisal.
I mean, I pretty recently heard this, the ratio, right? You have two ears and one mouth, so you're supposed to listen twice as often as talk.
Yeah, I mean, that's great. I love that. I've never heard that.
I just heard it recently. I fucking love it.
It's true, and there's, we have a, you know, there's a bunch of people that all want to talk about what's wrong with our industry, right? But I think the better approach is to be like, what can we do better?
Sure.
Right? Think about what's
wrong. Proffer a solution first, right? Rather than just bitch about the problem.
Look where we are. I mean, if you think about, you know, I've been bartending for 34 years. The last 12 years, last 12, two, even 14 years, 15 years, that's been a completely different part of this industry for me. You know, I may have ended up owning a corner bar somewhere, but the way the cocktail renaissance came about and that's what really changed it for us. I mean, if we keep on building people into rock stars and treating them like such, it's kind of antithetical to what being a bartender is, right?
You know,
I mean, there's supposed to be a certain amount of humility, and taking care of your guests is your most important thing. If promoting your own agenda is more important than, you know, taking care of your peers, the hospitality you show to your peers is as important as the hospitality you show forward, right? And you're constantly attacking your peers. That's just, you're a hypocrite.
Yeah.
You know? So I try to make the things that I express, you know, we can do this much better. We can do it. I mean, just recently talking about, you know, fake whiskey origin stories, you know, like that I ranted about that a little bit, but it is, you know, I am honestly, if you show me a whiskey and taste me on it and I love the taste of it and you're not telling me a bullshit story, I don't care who made it. If you're packaging it and I like it, I'm going to drink it. If the value is right compared to the product that's there, I'm going to drink it. I'm going to sell it. You know, I'm going to do it, but I don't need, it seems insulting. You know, I mean, it seems insulting for somebody to tell me some bullshit story about how they found this recipe in an old box in a room in an attic somewhere. And, you know, that kind of stuff is, you know, but that's the stuff that I think that our industry can do better. And I think that brands can show more respect to the bartender's intelligence than have to.
To the bartender and the consumer. You know,
right?
You're just assuming that your consumer is a dupe that you can, a rube that you can rope into your story and have them eat it up and literally drink it.
Bartenders
up,
are a little bit more skeptical to those kind of things.
We look at the world through a little bit of a skeptical lens.
Consumers want a great story to tell, you know, about this bottle that they bought. But at least let them tell a true story.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you're two guys that just had an idea in a bar one night to open a whiskey brand and you worked your asses off, and
that's a good story too. You
know, yeah, that's a good story.
Let's go with the truth.
Right. I mean, I think that's easy.
So we segued a little bit to talk about your voice in social media and how you're very responsible about using it. And I totally appreciate that about you. And I chime in when I can.
I wasn't always very responsible about using it.
Yeah, you know, that's how you learn to be responsible. You must be irresponsible first.
Yes. Yeah.
But let's get back to the bars. So you're about to talk about how they're special and different from each other in different ways.
Williams and Graham opened. I finally said yes to a business plan. We opened in November 2011. I still to this day, like, we got our ass handed to us for the first like 16 months or so. I mean, we had no idea what we were doing. We put together a plan, wrote cocktail menus, opened a bar. The bar that we opened was it was everything we wanted it to be. And, you know, we didn't know if anybody in Denver would even care, you know, if anybody would show up. We knew our friends were going to show up for the friends and family and the mock services, but we didn't know if the next Friday night, if anybody would be there. And we literally ended up getting our asses handed to us with a line out the door for the first 16 months or 18 months of that we were open. We found our groove in there somewhere, and we figured out how to handle the rush and the crowd, and how to work our waiting list. And I drew on a lot of friends in the industry, like, that had bars that had, you know, that had reservations and waiting lists, and to figure out how the hell we could do it, because you know, we have 65 seats in the room, but we don't stand anybody in the empty spaces, right? There's always, everybody has a place to that we can take care of somebody. So that is, you know, that's where we were. We kind of figured out where we were at now, probably like 2 years in, you know, and we still tweak. We don't think we know it all, but it's right. So that's completely different from Occidental, which is we opened next door 4 years later. And you know, the layout of the bar is like, if you know, it's a mirror image of each other. The bars are on the wall, there's a rail in the middle, and there's a banquette on one and booze on the other. It's like you just peel them apart, and they're mirror images. And but the bars couldn't be more different, you know. Occidental will fit as many people in the room as we can. You know, and I love
that's
that.
That's my style. Yeah. I love that shit. Pack them
and,
in.
And, you know.
Not because of, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm going to pause you for a second. Not because of what we talked about earlier, revenue or money.
Yeah.
It's because when a place, for me, when a place is shoulder to shoulder and everybody's there doing their thing, suddenly, instead of being at your table and at your table and you're at the bar, we're all here together.
Right.
Like, we're here together. We're fucking doing this together.
Right.
And I love and it when it's
the
full.
The energy's amazing. And
I love it when it's full.
And, you know, I think we actually, when you know, to go back to Williams & Graham a little bit, at the beginning, you know, the concept was to have all seated, right? And I was like, there's going to be no energy in the room. It's going to be flat. Like, we need a space to stand people so that there's movement and there's energy. And so we have this like community wall down the middle where we start people before we can get them sat.
Like a little corral.
So it allows us to bring them in and stand for a little while, get them taken care of, and then move them either to seats at the bar or a table, depending. We run the floor like that all night long. But that, I think that was a very important step for us, is I didn't want a boring staid cocktail bar where nobody is standing. Everybody is having private conversations with each other. Nobody interacts. I didn't want that. I'd seen that a ton of times. And
those are great. They have their place. Everything 100%. Has its place. I always say everything has its seat in the Pantheon. You don't have to sit in all the seats.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but we saw that, you know, I wanted energy in the room. I wanted movement, you know, and for that you needed people standing and you know, gesturing and talking, and we wanted a buzz in the room, like a, you know, so we decided to you know, keep standing room there, but not have people standing in the empty spaces, so people were able to have their own private conversations without somebody screaming over them at the bar their drink order, you know. Different from Occidental, where, you know, you're four deep at the bar on Friday and Saturday nights, and people are screaming their drink orders everywhere, but that people know where they are too.
Yeah, you
know,
that's the thing here.
And they can still, there's a pretty great cocktail list. You want to drink cocktails, you want to drink beer, you can do whatever you want there. We have all the sports packages, you can watch the game, you can listen to punk rock music. It's, you know, it's. I've never thought a punk rock and sports thing could work together, but it does really well.
Outstanding.
You know? And it's a New York sports bar in Denver. It makes me happy.
Yeah. And then along came American Bonded.
Yep. Just a year and a half ago. The actual project, it's funny because the project started in 2015. Or so, and the local papers wrote us up as the most anticipated bar of 2016. We opened in 2018.
No, time slips by sometimes.
Yeah, we bought a building. We had all sorts of zoning issues and problems with construction, and I still feel like it's on some sort of weird burial ground or something like that. But once we got open, everything fell into place. But it, you know, when our opening invitations for their friends and family said, you know, please come visit the most anticipated bar of 2016.
You know, if you can't take the piss out of yourself.
Yeah, no, you have to have a sense of humor about yourself. But that bar is a whiskey focused bar. It's just a bar for the neighborhood. It's, you know, there's a cocktail list. There's a great selection of whiskey, but there's a rooftop bar with frozen drinks and kind of a tiki garden theme, more of a garden theme, I think. Tiki, I don't want to use the word tiki there, but it's, you know, and on Friday and Saturday nights, it's nuts to butts in there. You know, I mean, it's crazy. Thursday and Sundays, we get good crowds and industry and everything. And you know, it's also become a place where the industry hangs out in the neighborhood, which is always, to me, an indicator that you're doing something right.
Agreed.
You know, at all three bars, we do industry specials all, you know, for people all the time. There's stuff that is constantly 100% always industry. You know, at Occidental, it's $3 well shots, which is, we don't have a cheap well. You know, we're serving, you know, Evan Williams and Pueblo Viejo, and we're serving things that people would be happy to drink. You know, and $1, we do Jenny creams for $1. Jenny creams, just a throwback to growing up.
Jenny cream ale.
Jenny cream ale, man. Just throwback to growing up in New Jersey, you know? And that was what we could buy cheap.
That's amazing that you do that at all the bars.
Yeah.
I kind of do something like that at all my bars. I have a key in all the computers. It's the same key at all the bars. It just says, fuck you, Russer. making fun of our good friend Russer Lomax, and it's a $3 charge, and we'll make him a drink and charge him $3.
It's, we also do food deals though too. We do a $5 burger and fries, and it's $8 burger fries and a shot. You can get burger fries, shot, and a beer for $9.
Man, what bartender getting off work says
right.
no to that?
No, nobody does.
Right? And I got a pocket full of cash and I don't want to spend it all.
Yeah.
I should go here to a place that's going to welcome me with open arms and serve me a great, that's a fucking happy meal right there. Yeah. You just described.
It's a bartender happy meal. And you know, we'll do it. We have the Impossible Burger, the one that's not all gluten. There's Beyond Impossible. I forget which one.
Yeah, I know.
One's just like basically a wheat burger, but we have that if people are vegetarians or vegans, and we try and take care of everybody we can with it.
That's amazing. So, in a lot of ways, you said when you first opened Williams and Graham, you were one of only two cocktail bars in town, and now there's quite a few.
Yeah,
and even some imports, right? Death and Company has opened up over there.
Death and Company came in, and it's an amazing addition to the scene. A place called Green Russell opened 8 months before us, and then we opened. There was the Cruise Room, which has now been taken over by Sage Hospitality. It's part of a hotel that has been around since right after Prohibition.
But you effectively sort of cracked the egg, and now everybody's making omelets.
Yeah, I mean it's crazy. Like, you know, we're the first. I'm not too big on pat my own back or our own backs, you know, but we're the first Denver bar, or we're the first non-coastal bar to be in the world's top 50.
Yeah.
You know, in the United States, and we're the only bar in Denver to win, you know, in Colorado ever to be nominated for World's Best Cocktail Bar. And I still think we're the first secondary market to win Best Cocktail Bar in the country, which is pretty amazing. You know, I mean,
didn't you take down Best Bar Team as well?
No, we were nominated 5 years in a row, but always had, you know, like Trick Dog and Nomad and Dead Rabbit and somebody.
There's always the heavy hitters in there, man.
Yeah, some big gargantuan, you know, those guys are all talented and it's amazing. You know, we're lucky to be on the same list, trust me. But yeah, we got that and, you know, bartender in 2014. And it's cool. I think that's also a function of social media, you know, with being constantly present on social media. You know, it's like saying, like, pay attention to us here in this city, you know, and people are, I mean, last year it feels like at least 50 bars that have cocktail focus opened in and around Denver, which is insane. You know, I mean, there's a ton of bars. You read the Westward, which is our local Village Voice media paper, it's you look at their openings and closing every week, because they post it, and it's an amazing amount of restaurants and bars that have opened. But people are recognizing the city, which is great for us, and we love that. And the flow of people into the city, of course, people grumble about it. They grumble about it in every city. I lived in Austin, Texas for 10 years or eight and a half, 9 years, and that grew exponentially while I was there. And then I'm seeing this happening again in Denver now.
And do you think it's you? Well, yeah,
it's just following me. But people are seeing what a great city it is, and people are moving to it. And we saw 32 cranes in the skyline.
Yeah, that's a signal right there, bud.
You know,
those cranes, you know what's happening.
Coming from, you know, sitting at this cocktail bar that's on the top of the hill. That looks out of the city. 32 cranes. That's insane. Mm-hmm. But, you know, traffic will, they'll figure that part out. But the fact is, it's a great food and beverage city. You know, we have some James Beard Award winning chefs. We have some great chefs from, you know, in mom and pop places there. It pretty much runs the gamut. And the bar scene has kind of followed that as well.
It always will.
Yeah.
Like, those are the steps right there. Yeah. It's food first, then drink, right?
Yeah.
I think that's super common.
Yeah, and you know, it's the best thing about, for me, for Denver, is the bar scene grew up in the culinary scene. You know, we all grew up in learning from our chefs, like, knife skills. We had, you know, when I was back at Steuben's in 2005, 2006, 2007, our chef was teaching us how to cut, how to use a knife, how to do our garnishes correctly, you know, all those kind of things. I worked with him on recipes and sat down, in the years before the Flavor Bible. He was my Flavor Bible.
Right.
Like, you know, I spoke to him all the time about, you know, what combinations we can do, what's great together, and that was important. And a lot of the bar owners now that are bartenders in Denver, a lot of them came up in the culinary scenes working alongside chefs. So they had an idea about flavor. They had an idea about that stuff. Didn't start with, you know, just thinking about your spirit first. Started thinking about overall flavor first.
Yep.
And composition and how you're going to get there. You know, the spirit is something that got pulled in here and there. You
right,
know,
to achieve the goal.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing. And, you know, I'm embarrassed to say I haven't been to any of your shops, but I will rectify that. I'm going to make a promise to you right now. I'll guarantee you within 1 year I'll come to all three.
So we're not going to sit down here next year and have you say that again?
Nope.
Okay.
So let's talk about here then. We're at Tales of the Cocktail. You're here with Liquid Productions, which I don't even know your role with them. You just hang with them?
What's going on? Yeah, you know, I just hang out with the guys and we batch and coordinate events. Liquid Productions is, you know, it started by Andy Seymour, who I worked with AKA Wine Geek before that. You know, one of the first few companies doing large scale events for brands around the country. And you know, Andy and I became pretty close pretty fast. You know, he's one of my closest friends, if not my closest friend right now. And it's just, we work together so organically, the whole crew. Like we don't have titles, you know. We get the assignments, we get the events, we get the gigs, and then we just execute. You know, there's no ego involved in the whole thing, even though it'd be really easy to have some. But you know, me Jacques Zadenhout, I can say it, yeah.
Zadenhout.
Tyler Hudgens, Leo DeGroff, you know, obviously Andy Seymour, Kathy Rimmer, like our core crew, you know, we all work together so well, and on site it just feels great. You know, we have people that work with us pretty regularly, Holly Booth and Jason Patz, and you know, it's very, very organic, so there's no egos, and everything's easy to happen on site, and we kind of all fall into our place. You know, we run our little sections of the event, and then it all comes together.
Yeah, I got.
There's a lot of organization. Leo DeGroff is an incredibly organized, very strange but organized person.
I make fun of him all the time for how organized he is in all that work, and then when you hang out with him, he's like some dopey dude.
He's so incredibly intelligent. It blows my mind sometimes the way his mind operates. It operates in a strange way, but you know, his solutions to things and logistically and you know, logistically and organizationally, he's incredible.
Yeah.
And I'm lucky to be able to work with him, and lucky to be able to drink with him afterwards too. Although, you know, I think he goes a little harder than I do at, you know, or long, you know, I'm now I get to use, at 50, you get to use the old man excuse. Like, I gotta go get my sleep.
Yeah. I've been using it a lot.
He's still young enough to be throwing down till late hours of the night. But we do, you know, we have a consultancy with, Live Nation. We've been working with doing cocktails for general concessions in all of their amphitheaters. It's 62 amphitheaters across the United States.
Whoa.
I've been spearheading that one. And you know, I did cocktails for Wiz Khalifa last week, and we're going to do some backstage bars for their tour. And
amazing.
You know, it's cool because my love for live music, I used to play in bands when I was younger, you know, kind of gets bring the two together, which is to me incredible. You know, I mean, I get to go, I mean, I don't get to choose the shows I go to. Unfortunately, sometimes they're not ones I want to see. But
even seeing a show, you don't necessarily care about the artists. You get to see like the whole behind this, because you're behind the scenes.
Yeah,
you're going to see like how it's all put together.
Yeah, we get to see
that's fascinating no matter what.
What happens with, you know, what happens with artist management, how the whole stage comes together in a day is pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And how it gets broken down. Like watching that whole thing, I just want to time lapse it. It's pretty amazing what they go through and how it gets done. But also, like, you know, producing cocktails and food for 60,000 people at a time or 20,000 people or whatever it is fun to watch. And, you know, we do it because we also do Life is Beautiful every year as a team.
I don't know what
and
that is.
Life is Beautiful is a music festival in Las Vegas that goes, it's over three nights. It's eight blocks downtown in Vegas. They close them off and there's stages all over. I think there's like 10 stages total, three main stages and a bunch of ancillary stages around. And there's 40 bars, 200 bartenders, and we do cocktails. You know, we do probably about 20 different cocktails a year and sell, you know, I think last year we batched 75,000 cocktails or something.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Just for that event.
Just for that event. And just the crew of people I just talked about. That's, you know, the production room, the tent that they give us. I mean, there's a system that just rolls and rolls and rolls, and we're making, you know, somebody's got to work in distribution, somebody's got to work in production, somebody's got to work in logistics, and somebody's got to get out there and get on the golf carts and check on all the bars and make sure they're doing what we need to do. There's training. It's a huge undertaking. I mean, we start talking about it in April. We just got some recipes now for September, but right. You know, that stuff has to happen way in advance.
What is it that made you say to yourself, I want to be involved in a thing that makes 75,000 cocktails?
Yeah. You know, I think
at once. Yeah, I've made 75,000
as much
probably
as
my
I
whole
love,
career.
You know, the individual cocktail and being at a bar and taking care of people right in front of you, the ability to bring what we do to a massive audience and kind of share like that thing mainstreaming is really exciting to me. I know everybody wants this, like everybody in our industry wants to talk about these like individual bespoke cocktails all the time, and that stuff is amazing. Like I said, every has its place. My bars do it, it's the way it is, but the ability to do that with in volume like this is pretty crazy. The challenge of getting it done and what we put ourselves through, it's almost like, you know, we go to war together, you know. I mean, it's the sitting around at the end of every night after that kind of day of work is the drinks taste so much better.
Yeah. You know, well earned.
Yeah, the gin and soda that we're sitting in a casino drinking when we're at the end of a night in Vegas is the best tasting gin and soda you ever have, you know. I mean, and I've spent my life trying to find tribes. I think, like I told you before, like I was as a child, I didn't have a ton of friends. I was always seeking people's friendship and seeking people's approval, and I realize that now as an adult that unconsciously through most of my life I was trying to find tribes, you know. Mm-hmm. Find something to be a part of that was just part of a greater thing. And Liquid Productions is a special thing for me. It's not, again, the business is great, the money making part is a part of it, but when we all get to come together in one space and we get to see it magically happen, it's amazing to me. And it really I love it. I love every second of it. I love, you know, I love even the challenging parts. Somebody yesterday, somebody dumped all of our juice in the morning.
What?
Yeah, it got left. They told us we could leave it in a walk-in. The kitchen staff came in and dumped all of our juice because it was in their way. And, you know, we had to scramble around, and the day started very difficultly, you know, in a very difficult way. And I was driving all over town yesterday picking up this and that, and we had our team here. It was all very well coordinated. And, you know, we recovered from it. I mean, imagine that. You know, you're about to have this huge party, you know, and all of your juice gets dumped, you know, all of it. And wow. And you have to get it figured out, and we figured it out, and nobody on the team is, there's no sky is falling.
Right.
You know, it's like, how can we, what can we do? Somebody's going to Restaurant Depot, picking up fruit. We're breaking out the Sunkist that we brought with us just in case,
yeah.
You know, and we're making it happen.
Yeah.
And we still finished on time last night. You know, we were out of here at 9 o'clock and able to go, you know, enjoy a little bit of New Orleans. Like, organizationally this year, it's amazing because we've had time.
Yeah,
you know, to actually.
Yeah, usually I don't really see you much.
Yeah,
to even have you sit down with me for this long seems like a
yeah.
lot.
Yeah, somebody said to me, you know, somebody said to me a few years ago, and it was a year after I won Bartender of the Year, and it was like 2015. They're like, you don't have to do this back of house stuff anymore. You should be front. You know, you should be up front. And I thought about that. I was like, but I love this so much. Yeah. Like this is great to be able to like have all these bartenders come in and have this great experience, and you know, be able to take care of my peers, our peers. Is so, I mean, it's a joyful feeling that I can hardly translate, you know. Yeah. like it's great to take care of your guests every day, but when you can take care of the people that work hard behind bars all year long and see how happy they are and what they're doing and all the high fives and the whole thing, that's it's a lot of joy. It's fun to do.
Yeah, amazing. Well, listen, we're getting towards the end here. Should probably wrap it up. I really appreciate all the time you sat down with me. If you wanted people to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that, to talk to you about anything?
I mean, email is a great way. I'm not shy about giving away my email address for, you know, for contact. It's just sean@bluecollarcocktails.com. Sean is SEAN. And I think that, you know, that reaching out to me through social media channels, through the direct message there, if anybody ever wants to get on that, it's Sean Kenyon 13 on Instagram and Sean Kenyon on Twitter. I was on Twitter early enough that I actually got my own name.
Yeah, nice. Yeah. Well, I'll post all your handles to the bars as well for our Speakeasy Podcast. Great. Instagram, and so people will see all those things too. Once again, man, really appreciate you sitting down and taking so much time for me. You're a very thoughtful person, and I definitely have had a lot of respect for you over the years, and anytime I get to hang out with you, I feel very grateful. Thank you so much.
Well, the respect's been mutual, Souther, and it's an honor to sit down with you, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, bud.
Love you, brother.
All right. Cheers, guys. Tune in to next week's episode of The Speakeasy. That's all we've got this week from Tales of the Cocktail 2019 in New Orleans.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Just enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.